Yeah, I'm easy to find in Southeast Asia, especially if you end up in an elevator with me. But anyways, my name is Adel Yusupov. I've been in Southeast Asia for almost 2 years, and I'm very excited about this assignment. It's really an exciting region to be in terms of the prospects for U.S. grains, U.S. exports, and also livestock and feed industry developments. I've been asked to talk about what's happening in my region and also talk about competition, what kind of competition we're facing in the market and how we're dealing with it. So, not much time, but I'll try to run very quickly. I'll talk about introduction to my region. I'll talk about some macroeconomic environment that's surrounding my region. I'll talk about new patterns and influences affecting growth of the feed and livestock industry. I'll talk about competition and how we deal with it. Southeast Asia and ASEAN, it's a 10-country community. The population of this region is about 600 million people. That is double of the United States, and it's a little bit half of China. To give you a perspective, the total economy is $2.7 trillion. That is a little bit bigger than India. Total trade, $1.7 trillion. That's America's fifth largest partner, trading partner. And total area is 1.7 million square miles. That is number seven largest area in the world. And only 13% of that area is arable land. So imagine, to put in perspective, an acreage about less than half of the United States with 13% of arable land available and with average corn yields of 60 to 80 bushels per acre. Anyways, macroeconomic environment, population growth is tremendous. Southeast Asia is going to add most likely half of what it has today by 2050. In 10 years, UNDP estimates that Southeast Asia will add a population of another Philippines, 92 million people to its population base. So in terms of the feed demand growth, in terms of meat consumption growth, the region represents one of the brightest prospects in the world. This is a macro environment, again, urbanization statistics. The graph, the columns would show you total population increase, and the line will show you percentage of living in urban areas. Right now, about 50% of the population is living in the cities. By 2050, we will have about 75 to 78% living in urban areas. Macro environment, I'll skip this very quickly. When we talk about the economy in Southeast Asia, we got to talk about China, because China is affecting Southeast Asia's growth and development. GDP, as you see, and you would need to concentrate on the very right column, that is Southeast Asia, excluding Japan, is growing and is projected to grow in the next 5-10 years. And that, I think, will be primarily by the demand pull that is created by China. As Chinese economy has been switching from investment export trend towards consumption-based growth. And that will create a demand pull for Southeast Asia-based product going into China. As an example, Malaysian exports to China have been up, were up 56% in November. Let's talk about Southeast Asia feed production. This, up to 2009, actual numbers, 2000 to 20, that's estimates. We are quite bullish, and the reason for those, for these estimates, quite bullish estimates, is the continued growth of the livestock sector expansion and commercialization of the livestock industry. In terms of the numbers, Southeast Asian feed production for 2009 was 48 million metric tons. That is the fourth largest feed market in the world after United States, China, and I believe Brazil, and then Southeast Asia. This is a little bit bullish. The data was collected by from the livestock industry associations in Southeast Asia. That is our projection for the livestock industry growth, encompassing three major livestock sectors: aquaculture, broiler, and pork. You see that aquaculture is looking to be the next wave that's going to hit the Southeast Asia livestock animal protein sector. And in terms of globalization, Southeast Asia has become and will continue to be interdependent with Asia and the rest of the world for the supply of raw materials and import and export trade. Early or late, the government will will have to make necessary trade-offs between trying to achieve local corn sufficiency and versus reliable corn supply to the region. And for the United States, trade policy and our trade affairs in the region will be the key to our competitiveness, and I'll talk about this a little bit later. In terms of the microenvironment summary, China's consumption-oriented economy will create a demand for Southeast Asian economies, and ASEAN region will be continuing to experience economic growth, and interdependency will be the region's new economic order. Macroeconomic and demographic changes in the region are very supportive to increased animal protein consumption. Supply of meat in the ASEAN region first will come from ASEAN, because ASEAN just entered into the ASEAN Free Trade Agreement effective January 2010, and with potential increase from meat imports from non-ASEAN origins. And of course, low inventories and undeniable population growth and urbanization rates will be in favor of grain and oilseed exports into the region. Now, I would like to look at the new patterns and influences that are affecting the industry. That is, I characterize them as old way and new way of doing things, and I'll be talking mostly about the industry, primarily trading companies, feed milling companies, and livestock industries. What used to be mom-and-pop operations 10, 15 years ago, or just opportunistic trading houses buying low and selling high, is now transforming into a commercial integrated operations who are becoming very asset hungry. And I mean by that, I'm mostly talking about multinational groups who are investing heavily in their back end and front end businesses, in origination of grain, in transportation logistics, in processing, in marketing, and so on. So the industry is becoming very, very integrated. We're seeing a fallout of small or mid-sized enterprises who don't have access to credit, bank credit. And amid this fallout, we're seeing increase of commercial and integrated activity among the feed sector. In terms of products, if what used to be 20 years ago just a typical feed mix of corn and meal, now we're seeing quite a sophisticated output of feed products, specialty broiler, specialty swine products. It is becoming a value-oriented end market. I believe the very last two points, just-in-time procurement and least-cost feed ration formulation, will be the main factors driving the expansion and growth of the Southeast Asian feed sector. New patterns and influences, trade policy, and I'd like to concentrate more about this. ASEAN Free Trade Agreement started in January 2010. It went a little bit unnoticed in the United States. I didn't hear much about it in the media, but the development is significant, and it will affect U.S. competitiveness in the region. My message to you, ladies and gentlemen, if you're looking for a message to take back to your congressman on Capitol Hill, please take this one. Because as the Southeast Asia region is growing and trailing China in its development and consumption trends, we cannot allow not to be in the region. And what's going to happen right now is that ASEAN Free Trade Agreement that kicked in January this year, China ratified FTA as well, India is planning to join, Korea is planning to join, and Japan is planning to join. Australia and New Zealand free trade agreements are also on the table. There is no U.S.-ASEAN free trade agreement that I know of being discussed right now. And I think what's going to... the founder of Singapore spoke to Obama last November during the summit of ASEAN in Singapore. He said that the United States is losing precious time and actually losing commercial battle to China in Southeast Asia, because China is interested in expanding an influence into Southeast Asia. Geopolitically, they would not want to have United States being a part of that community. So I think it is very important for the United States to have our influence in the region before an idea of having Asia without U.S. even gets established. Competition, this is a picture of Indian corn that was in Malaysia. But Looking at the graph to the right, I've listed Argentina, Brazil, U.S., and China. Those are the main competitors for corn in the market. I have to say China has been out of the market, but let's look at Argentina and Brazil. The black column represents cost, production costs, and the yellow round circle represents actual yields. So you'd see that Argentina and U.S. have very similar pattern in terms of production cost. Both of producers have low production costs, and both of the producers have comparatively similar yields. So let's talk about competition, major factors. I'll just be very brief. Good news, I'll start with them. 3 years, we have not seen Chinese corn in Southeast Asian markets. That must be all the good work that China office has been doing in the swine sector. Chinese corn has been coming in, but in very minimal quantities, and actually last year we had none of it. Argentina, it remains our number one competitor, a serious competitor. And by that I mean long-term, possibly competitor for Southeast Asia. It is, physically, it can put out full 12-month supply of corn, okay? But its political problems restrict the issuance of licenses, and pretty much a situation is there's plenty of corn, estimated at 20 million metric tons production and at least 10 million metric tons of export for this year, but it's difficult to get the corn out. And I believe with the political situation and with Argentina's indebtedness to the capital markets, I don't think it's going to happen this year. Brazil, another serious competitor, large producer, but right now most of the Brazil's logistics, transportation logistics, are bean-driven due to aggressive bean-growing program. So we don't expect Brazilian corn to be in markets until July, August this year. ASEAN FTA created increase in intra-regional corn trade because of the elimination of duties. So we are expecting increase of inter-regional trade, and that I mean primarily Thai corn going into Malaysia or Cambodian corn going into Malaysia. But again, increase is marginal. These countries are not in the position to increase substantially their corn output. Now, the other thing to remember is corn genetics are always improving, not just in the United States, but also in South America. I'll cover quickly India, hyped out. India is a must-sell market. They don't have enough storage facilities to keep their corn, so whenever they overproduce, they try to get rid of it ASAP. But right now, we're not hearing any corn offers from India. If there are any, pretty bad qualities because of the wet harvest and unseasonal rains. And Thailand is a very sporadic importer. In fact, Thailand on a supply-demand scale is projected to be short of corn at least by 500,000 tons this year. South American corn has been a biggest factor for us in Malaysia. Malaysia is the biggest importer, about 2.5 million metric tons of corn a year. It comes a bit $5 to $10 cheaper than U.S. corn. It's got harder kernels, which is advantage for grinding. It has higher xanthophyll content, the yellow pigment, which results in yellower shank. And those are the reasons I'm listing to you why Malaysian buyers like Argentine corn. Okay, it has, I guess, the most important factor that it comes at 12 to 13% moisture, which is a huge advantage for tropical storage conditions. It has lower broccoli kernel content, which is, again, advantage of storage, lower mycotoxins. And it also has shorter shipping times, 30 days versus 40 days. Our greatest challenge in Southeast Asia is, you know, it's what the U.S. Grains Council is known for. It's the marketing of U.S. corn. It comes at 14.5% moisture. We have dust problems, broken kernel problems. But again, this quality are as London and Southeast Asia. When I bring Southeast Asian team buyers to Iowa or Nebraska, when they see our corn, they want it. They want to buy it. Quality is great. By the time it gets to Southeast Asia, after 45 days and more in transit, we get some quality issues. It has less xanthophyll content, it has softer kernels, and longer shipping lead times. Anyways, but with all the competition talk, we're still bullish on the corn, on U.S. corn, and kind of a long view on the short commodity. U.S. still remains the only supplier, 12-month supplier, of corn to the Asian markets that can supply corn 12 months a year reliably and without any issues. U.S. is an open trade market, and there's a very low risk, and those factors favor U.S. origin. And I should note the availability of U.S. government programs such as GSM 102 also help us with the market share and marketing work done by FAS and USDA cooperators. So how do we deal with competition? In addition to the feed grain demand building that Carrie just mentioned, we're also looking at what we call sales-oriented marketing programs, which is a combination program where we combine importer education with buyer-seller matchmaking. We can also deal with competition by creating alliances, cooperation with U.S. member exporters in markets, education work, and assistance to members' interest in international markets. We could also find synergies with other U.S. cooperators, exporters, and other U.S. products to maximize opportunities for U.S. products, and I'll talk a bit more about this later. To give an example, we've talked about this, but very quickly, sales-oriented marketing, Southeast Asia Agricultural Cooperators Conference. It's an annual event, closed event only to VIPs, CEOs and that level executives from major grain trading companies, feed milling companies, and livestock groups. This year's event was held in the Philippines. We had about 142 participants from 12 countries, 90 major companies from Southeast Asia and the United States, representing 23 million metric tons of bean, meal, corn, and co-products potential. We spent about $150,000 to organize this conference, and the end result sales were about $392 million of beans, meal, corn, and co-products. Another example of sales-oriented marketing is we do Southeast Asia buyer education teams to the United States. So I know that our states have hosted for many times visits to corn farms, ethanol plants, transloading facilities. This particular team we brought last year brought in 33 executives from 7 countries in Southeast Asia from 29 major companies, representing about 4.5 million metric tons of grain and oilseed imports. We spent about $30,000 to organize this team, and at the end of the program, we had a special full day reserved for their presentations from the member grain trading companies. And as a result, we had a 286,000 metric tons of grain and co-product sales valued and about $105 million. So that's another example of sales-oriented marketing that we do. Another one I'll show is a DEGS marketing program. This is done by seminars. We organize road shows that would last through five markets in my region. This particular seminar is in Vietnam. We also do DEGS marketing through technical training. We employ 2 full-time technical nutritionist consultants who pretty much provide on-demand technical backstop servicing to DEGS customers, either nutritionists or feed formulators in Southeast Asia, kind of on call. If we have a problem tomorrow, we'll dispatch our technical guy to assist with a formulation or with an advice how to use DDGs in the ration. And also, you know, the picture of Ryan Legrand, our member who traveled to Thailand with us last year to present. We do seller-buyer matchmaking. Well, that's just a picture showing DEGS export into Southeast Asia. We have enjoyed continuous growth into the region. It gains acceptance. Inclusion rates are increasing, and we're seeing more and more people putting DDGs into the formulation. And that's it. Thank you.